This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service with another edition of Did You Know?
This is Par Tolson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin, and I am really excited today.
Bob, I think that you are always excited about something.
Oh, sometimes I do get really excited, but today I'm really, really excited.
What happened? Did you win the lottery?
Oh, no. That might make me really excited, but it wouldn't make me really, really excited.
Winning the lottery would be something really important.
But it wouldn't be really, really important. And I couldn't get really, really excited about something unless it was really, really important.
Okay, what happened that was really, really important so that you could get really, really excited?
Well, actually, it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to be happening soon. So not only am I really, really excited about something that is really, really important, I'm also really, really anxious, and I can hardly
Bob,
wait.
Bob, get a grip, and don't fall out of your chair. What is the coming big event?
The elections. I hope you guys are going to be voting.
Well, I certainly am. I wouldn't miss it.
Me neither. I think this would be a duty of all of us to vote.
And for whom are you going to vote?
Voting is a matter of personal choice.
Right. We may have different opinions about the candidates, but the final decision should be made not about what you personally may want, but who would best represent the whole country?
Oh, come on, you guys. What's good for the country? Ugh. We should be doing whatever we can to make sure our local favorite wins.
Our local favorite?
Who is that?
The little 10-year-old girl from the Outer Banks.
What little 10-year-old girl?
You don't mean to tell me you're going to be voting for that group from California? That would be downright un-American.
All right, Bob. I think you're losing us here. What election are you talking about?
The finals on Idol.
Idol?
I hope you haven't been watching that other program. This is Idol, the American program. You have to get involved here.
Bob, this is television.
I know. And over 18 million people were watching on just one night.
It's entertainment. Meanwhile, we do have national and state and local elections coming up.
And this is a national and a state and a local broadcast, so that makes this a national and a state and a local election. Everybody in the country should be voting, and we should be voting for our local girl.
All right, what about voting for candidates for president and vice president of the United States?
And representatives for different offices in government in our state and county and local cities.
Oh. I guess I kind of forgot about those elections.
I believe those elections are a lot more important than the ones for entertainment shows.
Right, Bob. Where would we be as an electorate if we treated our national elections like reality shows on television?
I don't know. Maybe a lot more people would vote.
Ouch, that hurt.
Yeah, but he may be right.
I am?
Unfortunately, according to the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, in 2010, less than 42% of the registered voters cast ballots.
That was registered voters. If you counted everyone who was eligible to vote, the number went down to less than 38.5%.
But that was an off year. We weren't voting for president. How about 2008?
Good question, Bob. In 2008, a little more than 64% of eligible voters went to the polls.
But that was only 57.5% of the people that could have voted.
Wow. Even with more people coming out for the presidential years, less than 65%? No, that's not really all that great.
And if we were to look back over the last several years, 2010 was the lowest percentage turnout of registered voters in 42 years. The highest percentage was almost 90% back in 1968, and that was during the Vietnam War.
There have been significant pushes to register voters who hadn't been previously registered, and these efforts paid off because as of 2010 election, there were seven previous years which had lower percentages of the eligible voters.
Which means what?
I would guess that it might mean that the people who were newly registered did indeed vote.
You know what I think? I think both the Democrats and the Republicans ought to do a better job of getting their supporters to get out to the polls.
You mean like the other parties do?
Other parties? What other parties?
Oh, like the old Bull Moose Party and the Know-Nothings and the modern-day Green Party and the Libertarians and the Independents and the Tea Party. to name just a few.
In fact, since 1854, there have been over 40 other political parties in America besides the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah, but I don't think there would have been as many people involved in these other parties. At least, not as many as there are Republicans and Democrats.
I wouldn't take that bet to the window, Bob.
No?
No, not even as a parlay bet. According to Dunhill International List Company, who put out a list of voters registered for the 2010 election, 43,617,103 were Democrats.
And 30,751,909 were Republicans.
And?
And 79,503,990 were listed as other.
That's more than the Republican and Democrats combined.
Still feel like stepping up to the window, Bob?
Yeah, the outside window.
While Bob's thinking about that kind of voting, let's take time for some politically oriented bell ringers.
Let's start out with some presidential palate pleasers. Did you know that George Washington's favorite dinner consisted of peanut soup, mashed sweet potatoes with coconut, string beans with mushrooms, and his wife's whiskey cake?
Did you know that Abraham Lincoln's favorite dish was scalloped oysters?
Did you know that LBJ couldn't find anything around Washington that suited his southern taste, so he had to import caterers from Texas to fix proper Texas barbecue and chili?
Did you know that Al Gore once said that being vice president meant that you got all the French fries that the president can't get to?
Did you know that Richard Nixon's tastes were rather mundane? For lunch, he often ate cottage cheese and ketchup, or cottage cheese and pineapple. And for dinner, one of his favorites was Salisbury steak with gravy.
Did you know that while George H.W. Bush's dislike for broccoli is well known, what isn't so widely known is that he had a sweet tooth. Stewards on Air Force One kept a supply of Eskimo pies, Baby Ruths, and Bluebell ice cream on hand just for him.
Did you know that Bill Clinton couldn't pass up a Big Mac? And Ronald Reagan never met a Jelly Belly jelly bean that he didn't like?
Away from the table. On a national broadcast, in tribute to the birthday of the 31st president, did you know how announcer Harry Von Zell referred to him? Mr. Hubert Heaver. Contrary to some beliefs, Mr. Hoover was not in attendance at the slip-up.
Did you know that George W. Bush once said that as a kid he never dreamed of becoming president, he dreamed of becoming Willie Mays?
Did you know that John Kennedy and his staff used to play touch football on the lawn of the White House?
Did you know that former Russian Premier Vladimir Putin sued the Harry Potter filmmakers? He claimed that the figure of Dobby, the house elf, was fashioned after him.
Did you know that Mount Rushmore Monument was never quite finished? The figure of Abraham Lincoln is still missing an ear.
And did you know that White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said, I don't know, 400 times during his first 6 months?
Did you know that in 1794, George Washington wrote a note to his gardener in which he advised, make the most you can of the Indian hemp seed. Sow it everywhere.
Did you know that Grover Cleveland once hired someone to enter the military in his place? He was loudly ridiculed by his political opponent, James Blaine, for having done so.
And did you know that the same James Blaine had done the same thing himself? You know, I've been thinking, even though we don't have the most of our population that turns out to vote, I bet we still have more people voting than most any other country.
And why do you think that?
Well, because I vote.
I wish your sentiments were true, but here are some other numbers, again from the Institute for Democracy and Election Assistance, from the same 2010 election.
In the United Kingdom, 65.77% of eligible voters cast ballots.
In Ireland, it was 70.05%.
In Australia, it was 93.22%.
Wait a minute. That may not be a fair comparison.
Why not?
Well, because in America, voting is voluntary. In Australia, it's required.
True, but there are a lot of people in Australia that still are not registered. And if you were to take them into account, it only lowers participation to 81%.
And in Malta, where elections are voluntary, the number is 95%.
In India, in 2009, it was 58.19% of the eligible voters who participated.
In Denmark, in 2007, it was 86.59%.
In France, in 2007, it was almost 60%.
In Italy, in 2008, it was a little over 80%.
And wait until you hear this one. In 2010, in Afghanistan, 45.83% of eligible voters went to the polls.
That's 4% better than what we did. And they were voting in the midst of a war.
Suddenly, I don't feel very well. Why do people skip elections when free elections are so important to maintaining our democracy?
I can't answer that one, Bob.
You'll have to ask the people themselves why they stay at home on election day, or at least don't even bother to mail in their ballot.
Because people are always blaming a president for things that happened years before. It's a part of electioneering. So, why shouldn't he take credit for things when he wasn't in office? Makes sense to me.
I think I may need a trip to the window.
Wait a minute, Kurt. Before you make a trip to the window, let me give you something else to think about.
Will it make things any better?
Better than what?
Think of the number of scandals that we hear about that are connected with a particular administration, but the president was actually not the one responsible.
Except that he was responsible for putting people in the positions that they were in.
Okay, fair enough. How about one of the biggest in the past days, Teapot Dome under Warren Harding?
What was Teapot Dome?
It was an oil field in Wyoming. Here's the background. In the early 20th century, the U.S. Navy had largely switched from coal to oil as a source of power. To ensure that there would be plenty of fuel available for the Navy, President Taft had set aside the Teapot Dome oil field and two other oil fields in Southern California strictly for Navy usage. In 1921, Harding issued an order that transferred control of these oil fields from the Navy Department to the Department of the Interior.
By 1922, the transfer was complete, and former Senator Albert Fall was the Secretary of the Interior with power over leasing the fields. He did so with very favorable terms and no competitive bidding to Harry Sinclair of the Mammoth Oil Company, which was a subsidiary of Sinclair Oil Company, and to Edward Doheny of Pan American Oil Company.
And that was the scandal? Fall had given preferential treatment to two oil companies over all the others? I bet the others sure objected.
And you would be right. But under the laws, at that time, Fall had done nothing wrong. The granting of the leases, even in secret, was legal.
Then why the scandal?
It wasn't the leases that got Fall into trouble. It was the secret payments that he received in exchange for granting them.
Between Doheny and Sinclair, Secretary Fall received a no-interest loan and other gifts totaling about $5.25 million in today's dollars. It made Fall a rich man, and his new lifestyle raised questions.
But he was also very good at covering up his activities, and documents relating to his affairs kept disappearing. On one occasion, his office was supposedly broken into, and lots of records disappeared.
Sounds a little like Oliver North.
That may be, but one record that he forgot to eliminate was evidence relating to his no-interest loan. That eventually brought about the downfall of Secretary Fall.
In 1929, he was fined $100,000 and sentenced to 1 year in prison and was removed from office. He also became the first cabinet member to be sent to prison for activities performed while in office.
As an added note, in 1927, the Supreme Court invalidated the oil leases and returned authority over the fields to the Department of the Navy. They also explicitly established the principle that Congress has the right to compel testimony.
I see. So, Garfield hadn't done anything wrong, personally. But since he was president when it happened, he got all the credit.
In this case, all the blame. His successor, Calvin Coolidge, got the credit.
Finishing with Harding, historically, Teapot Dome was considered the greatest scandal affecting the presidency until Watergate.
And that got President Nixon impeached, right?
Contrary to a lot of popular thinking, Nixon was not impeached. The House was considering articles of impeachment, but had not yet voted when he resigned.
Only Presidents Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were actually impeached, and both of them succeeded in their impeachment hearings and remained in office.
When we were talking about American presidents on a previous program, We mentioned the secret operation performed on Grover Cleveland.
That's right. He had developed a cancer in his mouth, and he was afraid there might be a panic if the people found out the seriousness of his condition, since we were in a depression at the time.
So, an operation was performed secretly aboard a friend's yacht while cruising down the East River in New York. The operation was successful, and Cleveland was fitted with a rubber jaw, and he finished his term of office without anyone being the wiser.
In fact, the details of this event didn't become public knowledge until 1917, 24 years after the operation, and 20 years after he had left office.
Why was it made known then?
As it is sometimes said, now for the rest of the story. It was that year that Dr. William W. Keene, one of the attending surgeons during the operation, donated the aforementioned tumor and some of the equipment used during the operation to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia.
The Mutter Museum? Can't the docent speak clearly?
That's the name of the museum. Now, you wanted something a little different, so here it is. In the 1830s, a Philadelphia doctor named Thomas Dent Mutter traveled to Paris to complete his medical education. At the time, the French schools were way ahead of the American schools in their approach to treating the sick.
For instance, French hospitals put patients with like diseases in the same wards so that doctors could better evaluate conditions of various patients and more easily gain insights into the effectiveness of the treatments being used.
Also impressive was the number of specimens and models that the French doctors had accumulated for study and instruction, both healthy and diseased. There were skulls, skeletons, tumors, hernias, blood clots, appendages, bony growths, and you name it. They had it.
Dr. Mutter was so impressed that he learned so much from examining all these exhibits that when he returned home, he started a collection of his own and used his specimens in his lectures at the Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia.
By the mid-1850s, Dr. Mutter's health had begun to deteriorate, and he had to give up his teaching position. He didn't want his collection, which had now grown to some 1,700 exhibits, to just go into storage. He believed that they could be used for future students. So in 1856, he donated the collection to the College of Physicians in Philadelphia, along with a $30,000 grant to maintain and expand it.
And so the Mutter Museum was born and grew. Soon, physicians from all over the country were sending strange samples to the museum as they encountered them in their own practices. Everything from fused bones and giant hairballs swallowed by mental patients to shrunken skulls from Peru. This collection was a major teaching tool during this period of medical education.
Was there anything else from anyone famous?
Funny you should ask. Of historical significance, there were the bladder stones of Chief Justice John Marshall of the U.S. Supreme Court, a piece of the thorax of John Wilkes Booth, and a sample of brain tissue from Charles Guiteau, the man that had assassinated President James Garfield.
But maybe most interesting for our North Carolina audience, in 1874, the Siamese twins Chang and Ing died.
Right. They lived the last part of their lives near Mount Airy, and they're buried right there.
It's true, they lived and are buried in North Carolina, but did you know that their autopsy was performed at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia? Now, most of the bodies of the twins were returned to the families for burial, but the museum got to keep their shared liver and the plaster cast of their conjoined bodies.
Is the museum still in operation? I would have imagined that teaching methods in medicine must have changed. I don't see anything like the Mutter Museum on House.
You're right. A lot of things have changed, and the museum almost didn't make it. By the early 1980s, the museum was all but forgotten, and less than 1,000 people a year visited. The College of Physicians had to make a decision, and they decided that for no other reason than historical, it ought to be kept open.
Their wise decision was to appoint Gretchen Wood as curator in 1982. She decided that the hope of the museum was to raise its public profile. So she became a roving ambassador. She appeared on the Letterman Show and on the BBC. She wrote a coffee table book and put out a calendar. Money started coming in, and now over 60,000 visitors come annually, paying $8 to $10 apiece to view the exhibits.
Not only did they maintain, they grew. In 1973, a man named Harry Raymond Eastlack died of a disease that turned his muscles into bone. At the time of his death, he could only move his lips. His fused skeleton became a part of the museum.
And in 1992, a baby was born without a cranium. Her remains were donated to the museum and are displayed in a jar of formaldehyde. Her parents asked only that they be allowed to visit once in a while.
Do they have many other strange exhibits?
Well, there's the soap lady. Early in the 19th century, a Philadelphia woman who was rather excessively obese died and was buried in a local cemetery. Many years later, the cemetery was being relocated as part of an urban renewal project, and when her grave was uncovered, they found out that the right mixture of moisture and chemicals in the soil had turned the body into a soap-like substance. She now resides in the museum.
And there are all sorts of obsolete medical devices that you could see. There are tonsil guillotines and lobotomy picks and even a device used to slice the brain.
A brain-slicing device?
You probably won't be interested, Bob. There's a sign at the display that says that it takes two people to operate, one to hold the brain and one to slice.
You're right. It's not a do-it-yourself project.
Were you considering working on yourself?
I guess I'd have to. I don't know anyone else I could ask to help me.
Moving right along, the museum also has a collection from Dr. Chevalier Jackson. He was one of the leading throat specialists at the beginning of the 20th century, and he kept a collection of weird things that he had removed after people had swallowed them. He had kept everything he took out of people's gullets, some 2,000 specimens.
They are housed in drawers with labels like buttons, pins, nuts, seed shells, and other vegetable substances, toys, dentures, and meats. That enough for you, Bob?
Oh, don't forget Grover Cleveland's tumor.
Of course not. Grover Cleveland's tumor, just for you.
Considering what we've just learned, I'd like a story. A true story.
You mean one that really happened?
Better yet, one that really, really happened.
I think I have one. Remember, we just mentioned Chang and Eng in the story about the Mutter Museum. The story is, well, kind of about them. It was written by American humorist Mark Twain.
And remembering things like the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County, this story is really true.
Yeah, but is it really, really true?
Well, just to prove it, we're going to let you read it. It's entitled The Siamese Twins.
I do not wish to write of the personal habits of these strange creatures solely, but also of certain curious details of various kinds concerning them, which, according only to their private life, have never crept into print. Knowing the twins intimately, I feel that I am peculiarly well qualified for the task I have taken upon myself. The Siamese twins are naturally tender and affectionate of disposition, and they have clung to each other with singular fidelity throughout a long and eventful life. Even as children, they were inseparable companions, and it was noticed that they always seemed to prefer each other's society to that of any other person. They nearly always played together, and so accustomed was their mother to this peculiarity that whenever both of them chanced to be lost, she usually only hunted for one of them, satisfied that when she found that one, she would find his brother somewhere in the immediate neighborhood. And yet these creatures were ignorant and unlettered barbarians themselves, and the offspring of barbarians who knew not the light of philosophy and science. What a withering rebuke is this to our boasted civilization, with its quarrelings, its wranglings, and its separations of brothers. As men, the twins have not always lived in perfect accord, but still there has been a bond between them which made them unwilling to go away from each other and dwell apart. They have even occupied the same house as a general thing, and it is believed that they have never failed to even sleep together on any night since they were born. How surely do the habits of a lifetime become second nature to us? The twins as always go to bed at the same time, but Chang usually gets up about an hour before his brother. By an understanding between themselves, Chang does all the indoor work and Ing runs all the errands. This is because Ing likes to go out. Chang's habits are sedentary. However, Chang still goes along. Ing is a Baptist, but Chang is a Roman Catholic. Still, to please his brother, Chang consented to be baptized at the same time that Ing was, on condition that it should not count. During the war, they were strong partisans, and both fought gallantly all through the great struggle. Ng on the Union side, and Chang on the side of the Confederates. They took each other prisoners at Seven Oaks, but the proofs of capture were so evenly balanced in favor of each that a general army court had to be assembled to determine which one was properly the captor and which was the captive. The jury was unable to agree for a long time, but the vexed question was finally decided by agreeing to consider them both prisoners and then exchanging them. At one time, Chang was convicted of disobedience of orders and sentenced to 10 days in the guardhouse, but Ng, in spite of all arguments, felt obliged to share his imprisonment, notwithstanding he himself was entirely innocent. And so, to save their brother's brother from suffering, they had to discharge both from custody, the just reward of faithfulness. On one occasion, the brothers fell out about something, and Chang knocked Ng down and then tripped and fell on him, whereupon both clinched and began to beat and gouge each other without mercy. The bystanders interfered and tried to separate them, but they could not do it, and so allowed them to fight on. In the end, both were disabled and were carried to the hospital on one and the same shutter. Their ancient habit of going always together had its drawbacks when they reached man's estate and entered upon the luxury of courting. Both fell in love with the same girl. Each tried to steal clandestine interviews with her, but at the critical moment, the other would always turn up. By and by, Ng saw, with distraction, that Chang had won the girl's affections, and, from that day forth, he had to bear with agony of being a witness to all their dainty billing and cooing. But, with a magnanimity that did him infinite credit, he succumbed to his fate, and gave countenance and encouragement to a state of things that bade fair to sunder his generous heartstrings. He sat from 7 every evening until 2 of the morning, listening to the fond foolishness of the two lovers, and to the concussions of hundreds of squandered kisses, for the privilege of sharing only one of which he would have given his right hand. But he sat patiently, and waited, and gaped, and yawned, and stretched, and longed for 2 o'clock to come. And he took long walks with the lovers on moonlight evenings, sometimes traversing 10 miles, notwithstanding he was usually suffering from rheumatism. He is an inveterate smoker, but he could not smoke on these occasions because the young lady was painfully sensitive to the smell of tobacco. Ng cordially wanted them married and done with it, but though Chang often asked the momentous question, the young lady could not gather sufficient courage to answer to Ng right away, not with him being right next to her. However, on one occasion, after having walked some 16 miles and sat up nearly till dawn, Ng dropped asleep from sheer exhaustion, and then the question was asked and answered. The lovers were married. All acquainted with the circumstances applauded the noble brother-in-law. His unwavering faithfulness was the theme of every tongue. He had stayed by them all through their long and arduous courtship, and when at last they were married, he lifted his hands above their heads and said with impressive unction, "Bless ye, my children, I will never desert ye." And he kept his word. Fidelity like that is all too rare in this cold world. By and by, Ng fell in love with his sister-in-law's sister, and married her. And since that day, they have all lived together, night and day, in an exceedingly sociability which is touching and beautiful to behold, and is a scathing rebuke to our boasted civilization. The sympathy existed between these two brothers is so close and so refined that the feelings, the impulse, the emotions of the one are instantly experienced by the other. When one is sick, the other is sick. When one feels pain, the other feels it. And when one is angered, the other's temper takes fire. We have already seen that with what happy facility they both fell in love with the same girl. Now, Chang is barely opposed to all forms of intemperance on principle, but Ng is the reverse, for while these men's feelings and emotions are so closely wedded, their reasoning faculties are unfettered, their thoughts are free. Chang belongs to the good tempers, and is a hard-working, enthusiastic supporter of all temperance reforms. But to his bitter distress, every now and then Ing gets drunk, and of course, that makes Chang drunk too. This unfortunate thing has been a great sorrow to Chang, for it almost destroys his usefulness in his favorite field of effort. As sure as he is to head a great temperance procession, Ing ranges up alongside of him, prompt to the minute, and drunk as a lord. But yet, no more dismally and hopelessly drunk than his brother, who has not tasted a drop. And so the two begin to hoot and yell and throw mud and bricks at the good tempers, and of course, they break up the procession. It would be manifestly wrong to punish Chang for what Ing does, and therefore the good tempers accept the untoward situation and suffer in silence and sorrow. They have officially and deliberately examined into the matter and find Chang blameless. They have taken the two brothers and filled Chang full of warm water and sugar and Ing full of whiskey, and in 25 minutes it is not possible to tell which one of them was the drunkest. Both were as drunk as loons, and on hot whiskey punches, by the smell of their breath. Yet, all the while Chang's moral principles were unsullied, his conscience clear, and so all just men were forced to confess that he was not morally, but only physically drunk. By every right and by every moral evidence, the man was strictly sober, and therefore it caused his friends all the more anguish to see him shake hands with a pump and try to wind his watch with his night key. There is a moral in these solemn warnings, or at least a warning in these solemn morals. One or the other, no matter, it is somehow. Let us heed it. Let us profit by it. I could say more of an instructive nature about these interesting beings, but let what I have written suffice. Having forgotten to mention sooner, I will remark in conclusion that the age of the Siamese twins are respectively 51 and 53 years.
Earlier we mentioned third parties in our political system, and we've mentioned some of the most well-known third parties in other programs. But in honor of the strangeness that seems inherent in politics, here are some other curious fringe parties that have existed.
Now, don't blame Bob for what happens next. These parties really did exist at one time. The Guns and Dope Party. They are like the Libertarian Party, which strongly supports personal freedom, including gun ownership and the legalization of drugs. Where they differ is that Guns and Dope advocates that all their members vote for themselves as write-in candidates in every election. They also want equal rights for ostriches.
I know this party has a weird slogan, like, what you like, enjoy what you enjoy, and don't take any crap from anybody. Does that sound familiar?
From Canada, there is the Extreme Wrestling Party. This party was founded in Newfoundland in 1999 after former pro wrestler Jesse Ventura's win in Minnesota. The party leader is Quentin Barboni, who took control when he beat 11 other wrestlers in an each-man-for-himself wrestling battle royale match.
And what do they stand for?
One member of the party stated that they don't need gun control. They need a seal hunt. They should be able to get in their boats and go out fishing anytime they want. They also want Canada to withdraw from NATO and a guaranteed income for all Canadians.
Be aware, though, that the Canadian Election Board does not recognize them as a true political party. I don't think it really matters to the members.
Also in Canada, there is the Absolutely Absurd Party. They want to lower the voting age to 14.
And why is that?
Who ever heard of a 14-year-old starting a war?
I guess they've never heard of gang turf wars.
Possibly not, but they also want members of Parliament to be selected by lottery, and they want the Department of Defense replaced with a team of rock, paper, scissors experts.
In New Zealand, there is the McGillicuddy Serious Party. Now, I like serious.
We would never have guessed.
Guess what?
That you would like a serious party.
Well, with all the true stories that really happened that I tell you about, you'd better listen better. Anyway, they want to start a Scottish monarchy in New Zealand, replace paper money with chocolate, raise the school graduation age to 65, and lower the speed of light to 60 miles an hour. They also want to restrict voting among humans to women under the age of 18. But they want to extend voting rights to hedgehogs.
And what do you think about those policies?
Well, the Scottish monarchy is okay, and my wife would love the idea about the chocolate. But the bit about the voting rights kind of bothers me.
You mean only allowing women under the age of 18 to vote?
Oh, no, that's all right. It's the part about the hedgehogs. Now, I know hedgehogs, and there are some of them that I wouldn't want voting. I think they'd have to have some kind of a voter ID law.
From England, there is the official Monster Loony Party. The party was founded in 1983 by musician Screaming Lord Sutch and advocates for the redistribution of wealth and food for the poor. They were also in favor of abandoning the euro and adopting the English pound. They wanted the minting of a 99 pence coin to save on change. Curiously, a couple of their policies have actually been adopted. These were the lowering of the voting age to 18 and the issuing of passports to animals.
Also from England, there is the Church of the Militant Elvis Party. This party was founded in 2001 and has but one goal, the overthrow of capitalism. Their reasoning is that capitalism leads to a free media, which they blame for turning Elvis Presley into a fat, drug-addicted shadow of his former slim self.
And finally from Hungary, there is the Two-Tailed Dog Party. The party is led by a two-tailed dog, the reason being that something as cute as a dog just couldn't be dishonest. In the 2006 federal elections, the party promised eternal life, world peace, two sunsets a day, a one-day work week, free beer, less gravity, and the construction of a mountain on the Great Hungarian Plain.
Well, that's it for our different alternative parties. So, what do you think?
For some of them, I can't tell whether they are being serious or just plain silly.
I don't know. For some of them, it might seem a little silly, but for some of the others, sounds to me like it's pretty much business as usual, don't you think?
No comment. Very early in our nation's history, our founding fathers found out that slogans went a long way in determining popular opinions.
Phrases like, give me liberty or give me death, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country, became the rallying cries that formed the spirit of a new patriotism.
Though the authenticity of some of these phrases was questioned in later years, it was certain that without them, we might not have had, we hold these truths to be self-evident.
It is not surprising, then, that slogans continued to play an important role in American elections. It might be rather interesting to look at some of them, where they came from, and how they were effective.
A few school children got through classes in American history without hearing Tippecanoe and Tyler too. This is the slogan of William Henry Harrison in the election of 1840. Harrison was the war hero who had won the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811, and John Tyler was his running mate.
In 1811, Harrison led a group of American troops against some Indian tribes in Indiana who were led by Tecumseh. A battle took place near the confluence of the Tippecanoe and Wabash rivers. The Indians began running out of ammunition, and Harrison won the battle and burnt their nearby town. In the eyes of the public, he became a military hero.
In 1840, Harrison was running against Martin Van Buren, and the Van Buren camp had nothing but disdain for Harrison. They saw him as little more than a backwoods bumpkin and claimed that he would be perfectly content back on the farm as long as he had his pension, a coonskin cap, and plenty of hard cider.
Well, Harrison's followers got the picture and so campaigned, not with platforms of programs, but with followers dressed in coonskin caps, pulling wagons with little log cabins on them, and passing out free hard cider to the crowds while they chanted, Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
The slogan might have been catchy, but when in doubt, reach for the hard cider. Incidentally, later critics didn't see the Battle of Tippecanoe as being all that successful. Battle results. Indians killed, 36 to 50. Harrison's men killed, 62. Indians injured, 70 to 80. Harrison's men injured, 126. And in the following years, Tecumseh rebuilt their town, and they became even more of a danger than before.
In 1900, candidate William McKinley used the slogan, "A full dinner pail." During McKinley's first term, the country had pulled out of a deep depression and had successfully defeated Spain in the War of 1898.
In spite of these successes, McKinley sensed a problem for re-election. The party was tied strongly to the interests of big corporations, and there was a growing movement among organized labor. McKinley felt that his successful campaign depended upon aligning himself with the common working man.
And what better image for the American working man than the lunch pail? And it worked. He defeated William Jennings Bryan.
Another feel-good era was in 1928, when one candidate made a pledge of prosperity for all Americans. Not just some would do well financially, everybody would. And the slogan to express that assurance was the campaign promise of Herbert Hoover.
A chicken in every pot, a car in every garage. And it worked. Hoover beat Al Smith in 1928. The promise may have been a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, but the reality was that the stock market crash came in 1929 and the Great Depression followed.
And an awful lot of pots went without chickens, and a lot of garages lost their cars.
In recent years, one of the most successful campaigns was run by Dwight Eisenhower. He was perceived as a true hero emerging from World War II, and he was actually courted by both the Republican and the Democrats to be their party's standard-bearer.
Remember that the time between 1951 to 1952 had been called America's Winter of Discontent. The people were tired of seemingly unwinnable Korean War, and Truman was seen as unpopular. He had even offered to run as Eisenhower's vice president if Ike took up the cause.
Instead, he chose to run as a Republican, and he needed a slogan. To the rescue comes Peter Peterson of Market Facts. His research showed that people liked to talk about how they trusted and felt comfortable with Eisenhower.
But they didn't like to talk about the issues or what was necessary to cure the nation's problems. He set out to find a good, non-specific kind of slogan.
And he found it in "I Like Ike." And enough people did that he beat Adlai Stevenson in 1952.
I think it's time for some more bell ringers.
And to start off, I have an election trivia for you. Considering modern times, what was the first area that gave women the right to vote? Ready? It was 1838, and Pitcairn Island offered the right to vote to all female descendants of the mutineers from the HMS Bounty.
Bob, that was downright sneaky.
I resemble that remark.
I think we ought to take away his politics card.
How are you going to do that?
Like this. Did you know who Wilma Slaghoople and Betty Jean McBrinkle married? Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble.
Did you know that a human head can remain alive for 15 to 20 seconds after a person has been decapitated?
Did you know that in the 1950s, under French law, it was illegal for any flying saucer to land in a vineyard?
Did you know that in 2001, Brazil produced a coffee-scented postage stamp?
Did you know that a third of pet owners admit to having more pictures of their pet than they do of their spouse?
Did you know that on Mars there are rocks named Scooby-Doo, Yogi Bear, and Gumby?
Did you know that the town of Ding Dong, Texas is located in Bell County?
Did you know that while on a tropical vacation, you stand a greater chance of being killed by a falling coconut than by a shark attack?
Did you know what a carry widget is? It's a puzzling question.
Bob, you are a carry widget.
Then it won't hurt if I get my political card back.
When we talk about the right to vote, we often use the phrase universal suffrage, but that phrase does not always mean what we may think.
Right. There were times when universal suffrage meant only white males who owned property.
For true universal suffrage, three elements are required: no property requirements, no gender requirements, and no racial requirements.
So, when did the United States achieve universal suffrage?
Let's look at the historical record. Early property requirements may have been dropped, but it was still a white male voting public until after the Civil War.
In 1870, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution was passed, which guaranteed the right to vote to African Americans, but it still only applied to men.
And it wasn't always enforced. Certain states in the South had provisions like literacy tests and poll taxes.
And organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, one of their purposes was to keep blacks away from the ballot box, regardless of what the 15th Amendment said.
Meanwhile, the condition of women began to improve, but it took another constitutional amendment, the 19th, passed in 1920, before women could vote. Now the gender requirement was settled.
But the racial aspect of the situation wasn't corrected until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
So that did it, right?
Almost. Also, in 1964, the 24th Amendment was passed, which lowered the voting age to 18.
I remember that. It was strange to think that a young man could join the military and possibly die for his country, but couldn't vote for his representatives. I guess that change did it for universal suffrage?
Maybe, but can you think of anyone who still isn't allowed to vote?
No, I think that's all. Hey, wait a minute. What about guys in prison?
Good question. And there is no one answer to that. Since voting laws can be established by the states, different rules apply. And this is what we learned from procon.org, updated as of February 24th, 2012.
In all instances, only convicted felons are involved, and so, in two states, Maine and Vermont, felons in prison still have the right to vote.
In 13 states and the District of Columbia, convicted felons have their voting privileges restored once they have been released from prison.
In 5 states, if they have been released from prison and completed their parole.
In 17 states, including North Carolina, they must be out of prison and have completed all supervised oversight, parole, or probation.
And in 13 states, many lose their right to vote permanently. If certain crimes were committed, no chance. In other cases, 3 to 5 years may be required. And in Kentucky, it takes a pardon from the governor after completion of the sentence.
Well, Bob, have you been thinking about the reason why so few people vote?
Yes, and I think I have an answer.
Good for you, Bob. And what have you come up with?
Well, in November of 2011, in Woodland, Washington, Scott Perry and Robert Ripp were in a race for mayor of the community. The vote ended up 569 to 569.
The vote ended in a tie?
How was the election settled?
Well, about a month later, with about 600 students present in the local high school gym, the student body president flipped a coin, and the coin toss made Scott Perry the winner.
Interesting. But how does that solve the problem of people not voting?
There were more students at the rally than the number of votes that either candidate had received. And there was a population over the age of 18 of about 4,600 people in the town. With 1,138 votes cast for the mayor, that means less than 25% voted.
Okay, but you still haven't told us your solution.
Well, both men admitted that with a little more effort, either of them might have encouraged one more person to go out and vote that day. Just one more person. And with only 4,600 people involved, it's easy enough to say that one vote would have made a difference. But with over 200 million people voting, it's hard to believe that one person's vote makes any difference at all.
So you're saying that people don't go out to vote because they don't believe that what they say will have a difference at all in the outcome.
I think that is what they may be thinking. What difference does it make whether I vote or not? I'll stay home and watch Idol.
But that's an entirely wrong perspective.
You're absolutely right about that. One person could still make a difference.
No, Bob, that's not what I meant.
Well, now, wait a minute. Just look at history. In 1645, one vote gave Oliver Cromwell control over England. In 1649, one vote caused Charles I of England to be executed. In 1776, one vote gave America English instead of German. In 1845, one vote brought Texas into the Union. In 1868, one vote saved Andrew Johnson from impeachment. In 1875, one vote changed France from a monarchy to a republic. In 1923, one vote gave Adolf Hitler leadership of the Nazi Party. And in 1941, one vote saved Selective Service just weeks before Pearl Harbor was attacked. One vote does matter.
That's not what I meant.
Well, wait a minute, Para. Let's correct Bob's facts before we get to his purposes. We have to tell you that this list and others like them have been distributed for years, but those facts are not true, at least not as presented.
What do you mean, not true? They were published in a Dear Abby column in 1986 and then reprinted by her sister, Ann Landers, in 1996. And some of that list was even cited by Jesse Jackson in his speech before the Democrat National Convention in August of 2000.
I hate to say this, but even if William Shakespeare had said it, it doesn't make it true.
These lists may have been cited for good intentions, encouraging people to vote, but you have to get your facts straight.
Which ones aren't true?
As you stated them, none of them are true.
Let's go down the list. First, Oliver Cromwell. In 1645, Cromwell became the leader of the New Model, that is, the Puritan army. He didn't become head of England until 1649, and it didn't happen by vote of Parliament because Parliament had been dissolved, and Cromwell was involved in the execution of Charles I.
And that did happen in 1649, but not by one vote. A court of 139 commissioners was appointed to hear the trial, but the moderate members of that panel were prohibited by Cromwell's army from attending the trial. Only 68 were allowed into the deliberation, and the order for his death was signed by only 59 of them. If the full panel had been allowed in, a far different result would have occurred.
Now, to German becoming the language of America. That rumor was probably started by anti-German sentiment during the 1930s. Over the years, so many requests came into the Library of Congress about the claim that they investigated. It all stemmed back to an event in 1794, not 1776. A group of German-speaking settlers in Virginia petitioned Congress to have a certain body of federal statutes translated into German and printed in both German and English. The petition was referred to committee and died. It was not even voted down in committee by one vote, as some claims stated. The one-vote decision was over a motion to adjourn.
Texas was annexed into the Union by one vote. Again, wrong. The vote in the Senate was 27 to 25, and the vote in the House was 132 to 75. And even then, annexation was not a done deal until ratified by the Texas Congress.
With regard to Andrew Johnson, he was impeached, but impeachment does not mean removal from office. It means sufficient evidence to force a trial before the Senate. The vote there was 35 to 19 for removal. But it took a two-thirds vote to convict, and that would have required a 36 to 18 vote. One vote did make a difference in conviction, but he had already been impeached.
France in 1875 was already a republic. July 14, 1789 was Bastille Day, and the absolute monarchy fell and a constitutional monarchy existed until 1792, when France was declared a republic. Napoleon came along and things changed, but a second republic was declared in 1848 and the third in 1870. What happened in 1875 was the adoption of the French constitutional laws, which gave the republic its form and shape.
The story of Hitler is the most difficult to explain. The year is 1921, not 1923. In July of 1921, Hitler resigned from the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Shortly thereafter, he allowed himself to be coaxed back in, but only if he were granted dictatorial powers. The vote was 553-1. That was the only one involved.
And finally, selective service. What was being considered was a change to the Selective Service Act of 1940. The provision was to change the period of enlistment from 1 year to 2.5 years. That passed by one vote. If the vote had failed, selective service would not have been terminated. They simply would have maintained the 1-year term of enlistment. Incidentally, the vote took place in August of 1941. That was 4 months before Pearl Harbor, not a few weeks.
Well, Bob, does that make a difference for you?
Yeah. That means I've got to find some new stories to show people that their single ballot counts, and so they should be sure to vote.
And this is where I think you are wrong.
You don't think that their vote is important?
I think it's very important. But if your best argument is that an election might be determined by their single vote, you are in effect telling each person that their opinion is the only one that counts, and they must get together and make sure that what they want is what everybody must have. Look at what's happening in politics today. It's like kids on the playground and one is saying, "This is my football, and if you don't play the game the way I want it, and I'm going to take my football and go home." So there. That's not what democracy is supposed to work. Democracy is not an end product. It is a process where everyone has to be involved to make things better for all of us. Think of the nation as a family. When you don't get your way, you don't drop out. Sure, some things don't go the way you liked. Maybe you didn't like what mom or dad were telling you to do, but down the line, maybe years later, you realize what helped the family survive was that they were all in it together. The same is true for a nation. If you have constantly placate the kid with the football or the one who goes off in the corner to sulk, you're not able to make democracy work for the benefit of all its people. We talked earlier of the execution of Charles I, and there were a lot of reasons why he was deposed. But did you know that while he was on trial, he said that he wanted liberty and freedom for all, but then went on, "I must tell you that their freedom and liberty consists in having government. It is not in their having a share in the government." Not having a share in government? Just do what you're told, and that's what freedom and liberty means? That's not democracy. And democracy is such a fragile system that it depends on everyone's participation, not only to show our differences of opinion, but how many of us feel that way. That won't happen with just one more vote, but it will happen when another 50% of our people take their voting privilege seriously. Plato once said, "The price good men pay for indifference to public affairs is to be ruled by evil men."
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and this has been our humble attempt in encouraging you to vote.
This is Parra Tolleson. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is generously supported by WRAL.com, a part of the Capital Broadcasting Company's New Media Group.
And this is Bob Martin. If you might be able to help underwrite any of the programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138.
That's 919-832-5138. See you at the polls.
I'll be there.
Goodbye.